Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everyone. I'm the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One. Just thanks. So welcome, everybody, coming to our April Fool's edition of Midrats. Nothing foolish going on here, though I tried to go turkey hunting this weekend and eat turkeys. Treated me like a fool, but that's a different subject for a different day. Hey, for a reminder for those that are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the page. You can line up with the usual suspects. As the show goes on, if you have a question or an observation for our guest that you think Eagle One and I just don't have a good hold of, feel free to bring it to our attention there. Roll it in. If you have a question you would like to just go directly to our guest, you can do that as well, and we'll pull it in at the first opportunity we get. And if you're new to Midrats, or for that matter, you want to catch up on the complete show if we go over an hour, because it does keep recording in the archive, you can always get the archive of the shows over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can get the free podcast over on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. Our guest today for the full hour is filmmaker Scott Kesterson. He's a former soldier and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. He's also now a military contractor working for CJ Sotif. He has made documentary films, also been a videographer, and he's a subject matter expert on senior influence and outreach operations, consulting in the issues of cultural narrative, visual education, and social media program development and training. And what we've done, we brought him on to talk about his next film, Bards of War. And it's going to be coming out this fall. The webpage is www.bardsofwarfilm.com. And most of the footage is from Scott's time in Afghanistan, where he has spent 2.5 of the last 4 years. Scott, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks very much, Sal. Nice to be on board. Hey, let me just make a quick correction here, just so we have some accuracy. I actually worked with SIFSOC A in Afghanistan this last year, and I'm currently setting up to do some work with Asymmetric Warfare Group here in CONUS. So just wanted to get that cleared up real quick.
Because we do have to get to our acronyms right. People do get grumpy if you don't use the right one. So thank you very much for the correction.
Not a problem.
We'll talk about some of your other work in a minute just to flesh things out. But Bards of War, if it's coming out this fall, if you could please give us a thumbnail sketch of what we could expect to see in Bards of War.
Okay, well, Bards of War was originally shot in 2006 and 2007 when I went over as a filmmaker embed with the 41st Brigade in their mission as embedded training teams in Afghanistan. I spent 15 months straight with them capturing their story, and it was a very unique mission because it was based on the only precedence of that mission in wartime was a combat advisor mission in Vietnam. They were very small teams, two-man teams to four-man teams, deployed into very remote regions in Afghanistan, working directly with Afghan units in the size of anywhere from 20 to 30 soldiers, and tasked with training and mentoring them. There was a variety of other rear support areas as well, but that was the part of the mission that I focused on. I also had a chance at that point to embed with the Canadian Army, the BPCLI, the Princess Patricia's Light Infantry from Edmonton, Canada, where I captured the first footage of them in combat since the Korean War. The film is it really stresses the human dimension of war, and it really focuses on the story that soldiers really can't tell themselves. It's not an apologetic piece by any sense. It's a very candid and a very direct look at war, told from the same guys I was with from the perspective of today. So, you know, we kind of look at the whole film, and I had very unique access. It was a very unique mission. And it was it's really a view of Afghanistan that we have seldom seen, other than seldom seen outside of the military. And ultimately, the goal of the film is to provide the personality of the soldiers that shape the personality of war. Bards of War is straight up a soldier story, and it's we've had a lot of emphasis, I think, in documentary work on the wounded warrior, and a lot of media emphasis on the pretty much the negative side of war. This is a pretty full spectrum piece of looking at war, like I said, from that soldier's point of view, both from the insane and wonderful to the crazy and taking to the edge of your seat. So, I mean, I think as we all know, that been there, war is one of those places of the world of extremes, some of the greatest and some of the worst things you're going to see in the world.
Well, how did you, let's go back to your background a little bit. Tell us how you got into this documentary filmmaking and what you were doing before and how you got your Army connection and exactly what got you up to this this latest film you made.
Sure. I was in the Oregon Army National Guard from 83 to 91. I was started as an E1, and when I got into my NCO ranks and accepted an invitation to Oregon Military Academy, where I got my commission, and then later was commissioned as a second lieutenant. Life changes took me out of the military. It's a variety of things, a marriage and an adoptive of two kids. Fast forward then to, I'd say, 9/11, which is, I think, affected everybody. I happened to be in Canada at that point in time. And at that point in time, in 2001, I was actually a small specialty contractor here in Portland, Oregon, doing, of all things, I mean, from where you look now, where I was then, it was a very different world, because I was focusing on outdoor living spaces and doing custom work here in Portland. In 2005, I decided to make a very significant change, and it was pretty evident to me that I felt very important, very strongly, that I needed to find a way to contribute in my own way and be part of what was becoming a significant fight, or what it was a significant fight and focus for our culture. So I began stirring up what I had done most of my life as an amateur, of just doing photography, and started doing that more and more on the side, and then started making a reach out to slowly to the Oregon Guard to find out what opportunities there would be for possibly embedding. I was very fortunate. I think it was the right place, right time, where I was offered an opportunity to do something that was fairly unprecedented. And I think some of that was just, you know, my past reputation with the Guard was always good. And they took me in willingly, and then allowed me to embed with them for a straight year with complete access. There's really nothing, there was no limitation to what I could see and what I could do. And from there, just the virtue of the work that I was doing, the risk that I was willing to take, and the reputation that I was willing to build, I was able to build with the soldiers on the ground, I think, is what carried the momentum forward. So that led to an initial attempt at this was a film that was never released called At War. And that was a very different film than what we're doing today. It was a kind of a snapshot of that year, but done in a very non-narrative sense, and it just had a lot of problems and never got off the ground. So let it sit for a bit, and I continued my work over there, and just kind of brings me to where we are today, which was the importance of telling that story. But I think what has really changed the perspective now, and I added a great deal to it, is it's a very different story in that it's being told by these soldiers that were actually there now 6 years later. The guys that are home, they're settled, and they're looking back on this perspective and on the perspective of what they've done and what they've contributed. And I think it's a very important voice to hear.
You brought up something that it's a question that my co-host and I, we bounce off each other now and then, without making him feel too elderly and crotchety. I guess we could best describe my co-host as a Vietnam-era veteran, or at least part of it.
Whippersnapper.
I just retired a few years ago. I spent a little bit of time in 08 and 09 in Afghanistan for a second time. Now, that kind of called out my little conflict. And one thing that always perplexed me is kind of a history nut, and it really bothered me, the treatment from media of the Vietnam War, particularly, you know, heck, until Forrest Gump came out, there really wasn't a positive movie about Vietnam. But I guess the turning point, it literally took that generation of soldiers 3 decades to get a movie that's probably a major movie that was worth them that wasn't a documentary of some type, and that was We Were Soldiers, that came out literally 30 years after 1972 when Vietnamization was complete. And, you know, here we are a decade plus into our experience in Afghanistan, but outside of documentary work, there seems to be little to no interest in Hollywood to try to give any artistic view of what's going on there. Being a, I know your documentaries is your forte, but I'm sure this subject has come up before. One, do you know, I know that Horse Soldiers is in pre-production. It's been that way for years. What is going on besides what paranoid people like me actually think is going on in Hollywood that is preventing them from at least making an effort to try to inform the American public? Because exactly like you said, except for those in the military and those that have made the extra effort to see some of the documentary work done there, what we've been doing for over a decade is terra incognita to most of the American public.
I really would agree. I guess, let me, if you don't mind, I'm going to kind of roll back on it just a little bit.
Please,
I think when we go back to World War II, it's very interesting for me to look at this because we see the role of the combat camera and the journalist is a very deeply embedded process of telling a story of war. And I think that, too, and we look at people like Ernie Pyle, for example, as a writer who is so deeply embedded in telling those very first-person and very deep personal stories, and even a journalist who is still honored by the Marine Corps and actually died, you know, in a firefight with them, to the point that the Marines were pinned down and stayed under fire for over an hour before they crawled in and drug out his body. We saw that the combat camera and journalists of World War II actually carried sidearms. They were that much integrated within the military system. We roll kind of forward to the Korean War, and as that becomes more of a UN action, and I think the culture is, I don't know that it was easy. They didn't find it as easy to justify it, perhaps. I don't know what the exact correlations were there, but media was, we don't see the media coverage, and then we end up with literally the capsulization of the Korean War called the Forgotten War, which ironically was what I first titled this project for Afghanistan, was a Forgotten War, until I stumbled on that and had some pushback from the Korean vets, and rightfully so. I wasn't trying to steal that issue from them, and so that name changed, and out of respect for what they had gone through. The Vietnam War, I think with the rise of media and a quicker access now to a certain degree of technology, was, and we had more of the roaming photojournalists and so forth, we had a lot of coverage of war, but I think domestically we were dealing with a lot of other destabilizing effects that I think we could look back on that were using the Vietnam War as a fuel to try to segregate and separate the populace, and we start to see more of the a rise of a belief that somehow the Vietnam War wasn't a rightful cause. And I'm not one that believes that, but let me be very clear here. The one piece of closure I take a lot of pride in is for all the work and all the sacrifice that was made in Vietnam. I take a lot of pride in the fact that we've actually won that war today with Vietnam coming to us to find security. But I don't know that provides effective closure for vets. And I know that, ironically, when I talk to military people, they tell me that they point to that picture that was taken by Edie Adams of the assassination in the streets as the point of historically that changed the Vietnam War. And I don't totally attest to that. I really don't. I think that's more of an inability of the military to capitalize on the transparency and the frustrations of dealing with an indigenous population and dealing with American values. And it has to do with a statement of the military's work there. But we find out that really, I think what we see there, and I'm one that grew up on the images of Vietnam, I think in my opinion what we see there then is the power of media and how much it can influence, and the shock of images on TV, we start to see a trend towards really selling and pushing media. When we get into the, we start to push, and then let me just finish that real quick on that comment you made on We Were Soldiers. It's quite interesting because when we look at the story, which was kind of based around Joe Galloway's experience as a photojournalist. Now, Joe Galloway, ironically, has become a very anti-war person. But I don't know Joe Galloway, but what I do know is his need to take up arms, which was an actual event there, to be, have to put down his camera in the sake of becoming, what I would say, being an American to support Americans, actually ruined his career. He was never looked well upon within the community because the photojournalist community tends to see the interaction with war as that piece, almost like an anthropologist who goes over to Africa and watches a cub die, abandoned from its mother. It's a piece where you're not supposed to interact. I agree and I disagree with that. I think from a photo point of view, I think it's important to capture the events as a non-participant, and that's the only way you're going to get it. But there comes a point that we have to cross the line that when all things are down, there is no choice. And you have to be, you have to put that camera down and you have to be an American before you become anything else. And part of your access there is based on being an American and being who we are and working with those soldiers. So then I think that what we do is we start to move into the 70s and we start to see media. There was we had our three major news agencies receiving it to a certain degree government subsidy, which was more like a BBC arrangement. But as we head towards the latter part of the 70s, we start to see those subsidies stripped away and rules change to where more and more media becomes purely driven by the ability to sell whatever you can sell and generate as private profit. What sells is hype, unfortunately. And the more that we've seen that trend go and the more that we've seen various trends within our society, we've seen a degradation of the quality of news reporting and the push towards getting into the front page headlines to sell issues or to drive hits on a website. Personally, what I think that we have today for the most part of mainstream media is we don't have news. I think what we have is a version of entertainment. And I'm very critical of this because it has nothing to do with the substance of the story. It has everything to do with how many hits you drive to the site, how many people buy your magazine or buy your newspaper. And as a result, substance goes away, and the emphasis really highlights not the depth of the story, but we highlight into the component of just what grabs people's attention. So we tend to jump from story to story to story, and if we look at, say, Iraq and Afghanistan as recent events, what takes the focus for media is the IED, the CIVCAS, the sort of things that from a cultural point of view disturb people. But we don't get substance. And I think if we roll back to Vietnam and to use your discussion, your reference there, I think I think that was starting to be identified, that it wasn't substance that people were buying into, even though there was a higher readership of an audience then. I think what people were looking at was and driven by the media, the body counts, and a lot of things like that. And the connection, the interest in explaining a story in depth as to the logic of why we do something and why it's there is lost in that translation completely. So, I mean, that's my personal opinion.
Well, looking at that, let's kind of explore that a little bit. Since the beginning of the last adventure in Iraq, beginning of it after, I guess it was 2003, there have been a number of military bloggers who have been made the effort to get their story out, the story of the individual in the war out. Some of that has currently been quashed by the powers that be, not allowing people to blog. But did you look at any of those blogs, and have you thought about what the effect of that is on the perception of a war from the people who were participating in it, or those who were really trying to research what it was like?
Absolutely. I think it's a good point, and I really want to make clear, if you notice when I was saying this, I've been talking mainstream media. I'm a massive believer in social media and the blogosphere, mill bloggers, et cetera. I think that that is really where we have found a lot of the substance, but it's been, as what happens with social media and happens with blogs, it's very compartmentalized. We have localized audiences that follow a certain blog or a certain writer for particular reasons. And the ability to get that across a large spectrum is not as successful as the mass blast that we get from mainstream media. Mill bloggers, I know that, you know, I was part of that initial movement, even as when I was referred to as a citizen journalist, but that early, I wouldn't say initial, but that early movement of really the rise of the mill blogger, I was very proud of that because I think it was a very alternate channel to be providing a deeper and different type of story. My interest in going to Afghanistan was telling that human story, that dimension of the soldier that has a personality, just like we're doing now with Bards of War. There's a person there behind the uniform. There's a person there behind the trigger. There's a person there behind the wheel, whatever we want to say. It's very important to understand that this is not just a silhouette, but somebody has a full personality. They have a life, and the life exists outside of that theater of war, and they are as important to us, and probably more so now than ever, as a person in our culture, because they've gone places that few proportionally have ever gone, and they've seen things that few proportionally have ever gone. And I would arguably say, I mean, that's one of the I was very fortunate, and I just kind of sidestepped that a little bit, but I was very fortunate in my Guard experience because all of my senior NCOs were Vietnam vet special operations people that I learned under and consider them personal mentors. So I was able to be one that really was able to benefit from that firsthand experience. And we're not just talking tactically, but I'm talking perspectives on life and the way that we look at things. And ultimately, I think that that's what we're faced with again, is a very large generation of people coming back that have a lot to say. And I think that the only ones really that have tried and have provided some of that context are bloggers. But we really haven't seen that within the mainstream media.
Speaking of a variety of voices, when you mentioned you spent some time with the PPLI, kind of sparked a little remembrance in my head. Back in 07, the Canadians, and I'll never fault the Canadians or the Dutch for this. I have a Dutch friend of mine explain it to me, that back when NATO took control of Afghanistan in mid-decade, the Dutch stepped up to fight relatively caveat-free in Uruzgan province with the assumption that the rest of their continental European NATO allies would get with the program, provide forces as well. Basically, the Dutch felt like somebody blew the whistle, they jumped out of the trench running and looked behind and nobody else was there. And back in 07, the Dutch and the Canadians, they both signaled that their time in Afghanistan was done. They were ahead of the power curve, so to speak. But like the Dutch, the Canadians also did a, in recent history at least, fairly unprecedented combat deployment. Managed to save, realized again how great armor was. I think really acquitted themselves in the field, and you can't fault them for going home when they did, because for their budget, they did what they could. Spending some time with the Canadian forces, what is your average Canadian soldier's view of what they're trying to accomplish in Afghanistan that would be different than your average American and people might find interesting?
That's actually an interesting perspective. I think that I find that the Canadians that I have worked with, and that's, I'm going to, and most of my connection with Canadians is driven out of PPCLI out of Edmonton. And they're probably the highest trained line unit within Canada. I find that their clarity of purpose is actually on a spectrum to the man. It's a much clearer understanding of why they're there. There's a direct connection, and this is interesting coming from a partner country, that they see this connection directly to 9/11. And and they don't. And I'm not saying that American soldiers don't, but I think in the melee of Afghanistan and Iraq, I think that there has been some loss of our way, and of course our numbers that we've pushed over there and the range of soldier that we've pushed over there is massive. Keeping in mind the Canadian Army is only about 55,000 strong total, and that when we look at their deployment numbers, in not in terms of actual numbers, but we start to look at them in terms of percentage of commitment, their commitment to Afghanistan was equivalent in proportion to our equivalent to our deployment to Iraq. So they gave a substantial commitment by their number structure to Afghanistan. The PPCLI that the guys that I remain in contact with and those that I worked with there were very clear on that connection, and it was a point that attack that happened on 9/11 was not just an attack on the United States. It was an attack towards the sovereignty of two countries and North America, which was Canada and the United States. And I've always found that very interesting because it's not something that they've taken on because we wanted it. It's something that they've taken on because they believe it. And it speaks volumes to the type of relationship that sits, I would say, underneath politics between the two countries. And the bottom line is Canada and the United States ultimately are of the same origin, and we've aligned with different countries, but we're all, the countries, and so we are both countries that are a melting pot, but we also find our roots ultimately in the origins of these countries back from the European descendant as far as the modern countries today. So when we look at that, I remember being in Victoria on 9/11 and how impressed I was with how they approached those attacks. I literally woke up in the morning to the attacks of 9/11 and found myself outside my home country as we were being attacked. It's a very unusual feeling to have. But Canada was unbelievably accommodating, and it was things like hotels that were carte blanche, just opened rooms up for any American to stay at without any question. You had in Victoria down on the waterfront, they brought out bagpipe players, which played all day. And customs people, as difficult as it was, you had customs officers that had to do their job but were so supportive of Americans trying to get back home. You had people, and I remember listening to the radio as I was driving back after I took the ferry, people calling in from Canada and in Vancouver, calling in to radio shows as the planes were being forced down and they didn't have the hotels had filled up and people volunteering their homes. This is a very different side that we don't hear a lot about, but I think it needs to be remembered because there is a connection to the purpose. And remember, this is Afghanistan is, even for us, remains that kind of center of gravity for all things that happened in 9/11. And we took so much media focus over into Iraq and so much emphasis into Iraq, but ultimately the Canadians stayed pure to that original center of gravity of focus, and I think that that has a lot to say for where the soldiers come from as well.
When we look back on Afghanistan, and I gather you've been mostly with the guys at the pointy end of the stick, is that correct?
I've been tied to the guys at the pointy end of the spear in one way or another. And even when I was working this last year at Sysoc-A, I mean, my focus was about how we, and that was also the philosophy of Sysoc, was how do we better support that person at the very point of the spear.
My question rolls off that, which is we seem to have an inordinate number of people over there with actually very few out there in the field during the work of that. Is there a tooth to tail problem as you see it from where you sit with this stuff?
I think absolutely. I think that's one of our biggest issues. Is it between ISAF and we look at what has become the justification for needing a massive back end? I think that this, we asked for the surge and we asked for 39,000 troops. There was effectively 39,000 troops on between two main bases in Afghanistan already, and they weren't forward deploying. So I understand that we there's a lot of logistics need. I understand all of this, but when you go to a forward point and that operational pattern, your daily battle rhythm, as they will say, is literally 24/7. It's a nonstop issue, and you don't switch off ever when you're forward. When you come back to the main bases and you find people working anywhere from 6 to 8 hour shifts, and they've got plenty of time to go sleep and plenty of time to do the weightlifting, and they have days off, it really bothers me a great deal. And I know I'm not the only one speaking that way in the sense of what the guys on the forward point see when they come back. I think that it became an issue of numbers, and I don't see that there's been efficiency as we have grown in the footprint in Afghanistan, and I'm sure that you can find people that will criticize my point of view, and that's fine, but I'll still stand by what I say. I think it's been a way overabundance, and unfortunately, historically, we saw, from my understanding of Vietnam and what I see today, those two parallels were there, that as the big army footprint expanded, that the main bases grew bigger, that we had a lot more people packing in the support roles, and that frontline position, ultimately, the proportion was a bigger back end than really was reasonable for the amount of forward. And then when you add ISAF into that, I mean, it gets to be almost comical, because you end up with numbers, but at the same time, tragic. I mean, I did a calculation once on my own, just looking at rough calculation based on the number of soldiers forward and the number of soldiers back in a couple of the regions in the south. And the ratio was about 30 to 1 from support to forward. Now, we consider the Army big at 10 to 1. We're talking 30 to 1 support to one person forward. And it was just, and that's ebbed and flowed, but it's an outrageous relationship at that level.
I call it the Craddock effect. Admiral Stavridis' predecessor as SACUR shape, whatever you want to call him. his last speech he gave last month or last week at the job over at SHAPE, he just gave a scathing discussion of whether it comes to their caveats, not filling out the number of troops they said they did, with our NATO allies in Afghanistan. And occasionally, because I'll write about it, I will get correspondence from people going, you shouldn't talk bad about our allies. I'm not talking bad, just stating facts. And I assume the time you've been there, you've been to that beautiful German base in Mazar-i-Sharif. Have you been out to Herat with the nice Italian restaurant out there? We have those. I will say, though, the Brits gave me a nasty breakfast in a tent full of sand, so I'm not going to make fun of the Brits. They were eating worse than I was. But the NATO would enjoy throwing out numbers. We have this many Germans here, this beautiful base there. But they rarely, if ever, left the wire. And when they did, they're caveat laden. And we put up with that for years. You're there in 6 and 7, which I think at home was when they finally made the decision that this wasn't working. Is part of the problem we've had in Afghanistan is we've been caught in that military habit of only wanting to speak nicely in public. And as a result, we have misled the American people, and really even worse than the German government and German press has misled the German people. And we find ourselves here in 2012, where people not only do they not know the story, what little they do know is based upon fried air. It's really not accurate. 5,000 Germans does not equal 5,000 U.S. Marines. Why has that story not been told or been told poorly?
That's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of reasons to that. I would add to that even the story of how we tell about the Afghan army. And let me start with that, and then I'm going to roll back to what you were saying. I read this morning in one of the headlines that Afghan army military has assigned a 3-star general to take over the prison system in Bagram. That means something in our culture, 3 stars. In Afghanistan, 3 stars doesn't mean shit. It means that you probably botched your way in somehow. So the legacy of military leadership and what we come to expect from training and integrity and the years of service to get to a 3-star doesn't happen within the Afghan Army. And so there is immediately we have a cultural perspective, which is essentially our own narrative that goes into what that means. And the press is good at this. The press tells that story and everybody goes, oh, wow, Afghanistan, a 3-star general. I might as well, in certain places, I mean, I could probably be as effective if I went down to the local Costco and I found somebody, a manager, and I stuck them into the prison because it probably would do better.
Yeah, your best case scenario is you'd have Boss Hogg from the Dukes of Hazzard, I think.
Yeah, guys, I didn't think you're about right. So so we begin by just this kind of what I call political vanilla. We like to take everything and turn it into our story and make it as if everything is equal. Everything is not. That's just exactly to your point. When we look at the European narrative, we have a multitudes of narratives. And I think that the bigger story about Afghanistan for NATO was the fact that we actually got NATO to begin to work as a force rather than an associational alliance of multiple nations with their own agendas. But the problem in going into Afghanistan and the way that it was, every country sold it to their populace differently. The Italians sold it for one thing. The Dutch sold it for another reason. The Danes sold it for another reason. The Brits sold it for another reason. And we see all of these key agendas coming out. And for Brits, the one thing that caught traction for Afghanistan was the Opium War. For the Dutch, it was policing and police, you know, stabilizing through policekeeping, for police actions, not military actions. For the Italians, it was stabilization and police efforts over in Herat. So we start to see all of these little agendas that cropped up. For the Canadians, there was a mentoring piece, but there was also more of an embracement of a warfighting piece. And I'm not going to take the warfighting piece away from the Brits by any means, but you were convoluted with it being whether it was an actual mission to warfight or whether it was a mission to eradicate drugs. So taking that to every single country out there that came under what we call ISAF, which is NATO augmented by all these other fringe countries that we want to bring into the alliance, which is really more of a partnership of the bribed when you really get down to it, because you have a core element of NATO that has been brought in and worked as NATO, and then you have all these fringe countries that we were trying to get roped in to get the experience. But at the end of the day, I would argue that it was a deal that you couldn't turn down. When you take Lithuania and you say, hey, you come over here, you take a variety of other countries and you say, hey, if you come over here, we'll pay for your military. We'll pay for their uniforms. We'll pay for their training. We'll pay for their flight in. Who wouldn't turn that down if you're a military leader? It costs you zero. It gives your troops some experience. But I would argue that that becomes, rather than becoming a coalition, as we say, it becomes a coalition of the bribed. So, again, you've got multiple agendas. Compounded with that was our focus, so heavy focus on Iraq, that we couldn't afford to be critical of the NATO allies, because that back end of what Afghanistan, as it became, was initially the primary war, became the second war as we pushed all effort into Iraq, and it became the place where everybody wanted to, everybody in the U.S. military that was a tactical type mind wanted to play. Afghanistan is a really different environment, a very, very complex environment. It's I think well said about Iraq that if you could switch the oil on, once you switch the oil on, you were starting to get stability. Afghanistan has nothing like that. It has only the tradition of being segregated and having to deal with just the basics of infrastructure development. So I think that where you get there then is a narrative that comes out of that you have to have a narrative of delicacy, politics, and compromise rather than a narrative of truth. And you don't want to upset the European allies, because they all have their own personal agendas, and you need them The irony of the whole thing is that when we really look at, when we started to look at the surge under Petraeus, that a lot of that is, we look at the places the Americans started to take back over. We handed Helmand over to the Brits in August of 2006. We started to hand over to the ISAF / NATO allies whole sections to run under a NATO command rather than a U.S. command. And for the most part, I wouldn't say that there was success there. When you look at, when you start to look at the surge and how many of those places we started to take back under, over our control, even though it was technically ISAF, it was American forces doing the job. At the end of the day, it was a war that ultimately needed to be fought and run by us. So that's just one of those corners they put themselves in. I think that when we look at the main piece here is we were just so overextended with the two wars.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your movie, and I'm going to ask you to kind of compare it to Sebastian Junger's book, War, and the Restepo movie that was also part of his effort over there. Is there a similarity, or are you doing something completely different?
No, I think that there, in the core sense of getting down to the soldiers level, there is a similarity. I have a great deal of respect for Restrepo. In fact, they started filming in 2007 when I was rolling out of country. What Restrepo does and what Bars of War doesn't do, Restrepo focuses purely on one unit, one local story, and it's a conventional unit doing similar but a very, in many ways, a conventional mission. And that's not taking away from what those soldiers went through by any sense. There's also a very important piece here is that Restrepo focuses on, when you talk about a traditional unit, your soldiers are also relatively young. Your age group that you're focusing on in there is probably, what I've seen looks like about 18 to about 27 years old. When we look at Bards of War is not centered in one location. In fact, it moves from the east. It covers the areas of the east over by Ghazni and Wazikwa. We go to Zabul province and go up into the areas of Cochran and Karni, which are north of Kalat, which is the capital of that province, by about 3 to 4 hours. You work in with the areas of Sangin, Panjiway, and Helmand, and I also get up into Aruzagan, way up in a fire base called Firebase Cobra. The unit mission was different. It was small teams, like I said, with the exception of the work with PPCLI, the Canadians, where that was a more traditional kinetic type fight. But nonetheless, what you're dealing with is multiple regions and a story that has threaded through there that has a narrative thread, which has been part of the challenge as well. And that giving a glimpse of a bigger picture of Afghanistan, but also that down and dirty element, because and I think that's a big subtext, because when you talk about that war, you talk about it that way, you start to find out that the soldiers, whether they were in an area of east or southeast, whatever, the experiences and a lot of the things they're going through are very similar. Also, I think there's a very close proximity of living to the Afghans, closer than what you see in Restrepo. These guys are literally living and partnering with the Afghans in a very, I don't think we've seen it any closer other than Special Forces missions. And a lot of these guys, in fact, later on, and at one point even in the film, there is a partnership directly with Special Forces. So there is that mission is much more of an indigenous-based mission of not led and doing the relationships to the local purely as Americans, but doing it as embedded trainers with the Afghans in the lead.
That leads into something that, you mentioned how young the people are you're with, but back as a JO, I had the pleasure of serving with some senior enlisted guys who caught the last end of the Vietnam War, and they had one tour, and I remember running into a Master Chief who did two tours, and three tours in Vietnam was just huge. Usually it was one or two tours of Vietnam. But we have people, young men and women, who have gone on 3, 4 or more. In your time with the troops, was there a couple of occasions with relatively young-looking soldiers that kind of took you aback when you looked at how many deployments they've actually been on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that even looking at one of the guys in the film, Joe Tumbaga, who's, you know, I think now he's 6 years out. I'm thinking he's in his early 30s, but keeping in mind that he's had about 4 tours, and he's been to Iraq and some pretty thick stuff. He was he's also came from 101st Rakasans. So here was a guy that, and you know, the experience that he has for his age is pretty phenomenal. So there's a maturity factor that kicks in there that I think is sometimes hard to reconcile. And I'm not speaking for him, but I'm speaking in his observation. And I think it's hard to reconcile both for the soldier and both for the culture, because these sorts of people, regardless of age, but in particular when you get to a younger soldier that has had this much first-line experience, there is a perspective on life and a maturity that settles in that changes the way that they, how they value things within culture. And that is, and some of those things don't make a lot of sense to people outside. I mean, I remember a soldier telling me, it's like, you know, you go home and people are getting upset over the phone bill. I said, I couldn't give a fuck, excuse me. But I mean, that's just, that was a quote. He said, it doesn't make any sense to me, because the bottom line is that he's seen stuff that nobody cares about. I mean, he's seen stuff that nobody understands, they really can't relate to, and he's looking at stuff that spins people up, and it's like, this is no big deal. It's just a matter of writing a check. So it's very, that's one problem. I think the other piece that is important, and when we really get into the maturity, and when you start to look at it, take the majority of the guys that were in the that are in the film Birds of War, being an older soldier going into war, which is what you get with a more senior deployment of a National Guard type soldier. A lot of these guys have prior service experience that are in the Guard when they come in. So when they start from that perspective, their lens on war is very different as well. I mean, they've already been through their 20s. They're heading into their late 20s, or they're in their early 30s. And the way that they see things, the sort of the patience, the acceptance of experiences, many of the things that they're seeing are just framed completely different. So there's a grounding piece that they approach, and it's just a maturity, and it's no insult to any sort of soldier at all, but it's just when you're doing this type of mission that was so out there on the edge, it's a very difficult mission to begin with. And what that really puts them into is that sort of category of what we've seen in the older type of special forces operator, where they were a very senior enlisted or with a lot of experience in regular army before they came into the special forces program. And you get a much more grounded approach to what can be very challenging, challenging problems and environments.
What is the source of the title of your new movie, The Bards of, what's The Bards?
Well, that's a good question. And actually we've been hitting around it on the entire thing. Bards in the old sense were storytellers. And really when we roll back to, say, a period of old Scottish era, the early Scottish era, or even the old Celtic, the lore is told by the bards that go to war, literally, and capture those stories. But there's another part of that that's really important, is that those bards told not just the story of war and the stories of victory or the heroism of war, but they also passed on the wisdom. And there sits the kind of the crux of how I see each of these soldiers. They are our modern bards. They are the storytellers of this era, and they are the ones who have seen it. They are the ones who can tell the story, but they're also the keepers of some of the greatest wisdom that we can gain as a culture if we learn to listen. Soldiers don't always talk in ways that we want to hear. Sometimes it's too direct. Sometimes it's a little coarse. But within there is a wisdom. There is a poetry. There is an experience level that we need to listen to, because they really become become an influence and a guide and to a culture as a whole. And I think then the greatest misperceptions when we look at soldiers is the idea that somehow if they've gone to war, you know, they're just kind of this adrenaline perception. It's like, well, they've gone to war and these guys are just warring monsters. That's far from the truth. I have yet to meet a soldier that has been in heavy conflict who comes away and doesn't say, I don't want war. However, this was my job. This is what I see to do, and I'll do what I have to do to protect my country. Those are some. That's a very different value place. There's also a significant value shift when you take a soldier who goes to that point, goes to the edge, and they're willing to give their life literally for a belief system. And that's a consistent theme with all soldiers that I just don't think has been well highlighted. On a daily basis, I mean, if I walk down the street and say, hey, you know, would you jump in front of a bullet for me if someone comes out of here? And I guarantee 99% of the public will say, no, I'm going to run to save myself. But you're talking about a minority group of people that have deployed into extreme zones that have said basically that. I will put my safety in full harm's way with the acceptance of death to protect the values of my country, my flag, and the people back home. And just to add to that, I remember in 2008 when I was over there, and 2008 was right in the elections, and we were, and there was a lot of hostile things being said in the elections with those who were pro Obama, and I found it to be disproportional to what was being, to the reality, but a lot of pretty harsh things said towards soldiers. And I asked them one day, I said, how does this make you feel? And I asked a number of them. It was just one, not just one. And I was always impressed by the response, which was, I don't like it, but at the same time, I respect it because that's what freedom of speech means. And that's what my job is here, is to make sure that those values are upheld. That's a higher level positioning within that argument than anybody in the public sphere was taking.
I'd like to kind of build on that a little bit. Going back to the first question I asked, it's always been a burr under my saddle where our traditional ways of telling stories have refused in almost a hostile way to try to tell the story the last 10 years is because of the misperceptions out there. When I retired over 2 years ago, and decided to be a civilian, I actually ran into those misperceptions in pursuing jobs. Originally, I thought it was very humorous, some people's assumptions, but then I found it something besides humorous. But we find ourselves in 2012. You know, when you were there in 2008, and the election period is when the first part of the surge was starting to come in as forces were able to shift from Iraq over to Afghanistan. McKiernan had been working on Shape, Clear, Hold, Build, which was going to try to leverage those additional forces come on. McChrystal picked up from there. Petraeus did as well. Trying to perhaps get something, if you can't call it a victory, call it better than we left, like we did in Iraq. And what we find ourselves first quarter of calendar year 2012, and the public support for the Afghan war has cratered. What is this, a leadership in a messaging, or is there something else going on that you think is leading the support for the conflict to crater?
I think it centers around a messaging thing. I think that when we as messaging, not thing, but a messaging problem and a failure. Capturing the narrative of this war has just not been done, and the moving runs from a variety of levels, some of it's understandable, but it's a matter of keeping pace with how fast and how important getting transparency is to this public, or at least as much as we can give it. We're in an information age, and I think if we roll back to the beginning of the war, I've said many times that it's really quite interesting when we look current day, and we could even take the two extreme movements of Occupy, and we take a look at the Tea Party movement. And when you really dig down to the core of what those movements are pushing for. There's a distrust in government. And that distrust tapers right back to 9/11. And it tapers back to to the doubt of what is being told to the public that actually happened. This is one of the only wars it is the only war we've ever had where the public actually believes that 9/11 was likely a conspiracy. And I won't say public universally, but there's a lot of people out there that believe this. But a lot of that disconnect comes from an appreciation for where how non-traditional and social media was beginning to arise. This is my opinion, but I'll be real clear on this. It's when you look at the Bush administration early on, they were not a media, an alternate media savvy organization. And so the importance of getting that message out and maintaining clarity and transparency just was not respected. The various events that happened then over the course of the years reinforced that in many ways. If we look at Abu Ghraib, for example, and even that's not obviously not a film or Afghan-related problem, but it's a significant event within the issue of credibility. Because Abu Ghraib, there was a notice several weeks before that article ever ran that said they were running this photo, and the news agencies were reaching out to, in which hit Rumsfeld's desk, actually, to reach out and say, this is going to come. We need your comment on it. And instead of turning this into a transparent issue to say we have a problem and making a very forthcoming position on it, went to a reactive position, which is classic type old-style communication. Say nothing but react only to the story once it comes out. That absolutely, I'd say, it was one of the most devastating events of the credibility for the two wars. And so instead of an event where the public hears it, because I have always argued the American public is an extremely forgiving public, as long as it understands that, for the most part, the American public accepts that people are human. And I give them a lot of credit. I take away our extremes of the talk, whether it be conservative or liberal. The mainstream American public is a very grounded and very, very forgiving public because it does look at things from a humanist point of view, ultimately. So we do make mistakes. And mistakes are made in war. But if we try to hide it, that's where the other side of the American public is kind of interesting because it flips very quickly to a belief of government trying to hide something from the people. And ultimately, that's one of the biggest challenges I think that is faced right now from whether it's Department of Defense, Department of State, or just government leadership in general, is appreciating that we have the rise of social media, that there is a really important piece here to maintain higher levels of transparency. That doesn't mean give things away, but it does mean being proactive and telling the forward-leaning narrative rather than being the reactive narrative. The other piece that we failed to do was to highlight heroes. We did nothing. We created heroes in Jessica Lynch and other things. It ended up being false gods. I mean, the stories that the people that we identified weren't who we thought they were. The government pushed these ideas on us, and as those stories started to unravel, we started to see that they weren't who they were claimed to be. So we didn't need to manufacture heroes. We needed to highlight the existing heroes. The stories that I get, and some of those that I can tell and some that you're not allowed to tell, but it's the stories of events and things that truly are heroic deeds at the human level, whether it's the operations of a special forces team or whether it's a guy who's down on the ground just as a line infantryman, there are great things. And that doesn't mean heroic deeds means charging a bunker and throwing a grenade, which did happen many times. But it is also the stories of the humanistic side of what is it to really be an American soldier. The soldier that deploys over there and takes a dog, for example, has a dog on a fire base and knows that if he leaves, that dog is going to die, and spends thousands of dollars of his own money to have it vet certified, driven by a taxi over to Pakistan, put on a plane, flown back to the States, and assumes control of that dog when he gets back to give it a great life. Or, because deal with adoption issues because of the Muslim culture. So there is that component. So I don't think that we've done, and I put a lot of that onus on the military, in adapting to a culture. It's very protective of what it can say, but I think that there needs to be a real strong evaluation of what we do say, because it's important that people feel you are ultimately a volunteer force, and it's a force that's connected to the populace. And it's not about being political, but it's about telling the narratives that highlight the events that are not just great events in killing an enemy, but it's also the great events of being an American. Unfortunately, by not doing that early on, when we got to later times, you're playing catch-up, and you're still playing reactive media. And the end of the day, the needs of the media to sell hype outweighed the needs of the media to sell a narrative that meant substance, that provided substance to the American public.
Well, Scott, this has been a very fast hour. Your comments have been well taken. Tell us again, we're going into overtime here, but tell us again, when's the movie coming out, and what kind of theaters do you expect this to be shown in, or where can we find this movie?
Okay, the website for the film is bardsofwarfilm.com, that's B-A-R-D-S of warfilm.com, all one word. The film is going to be a direct-to-DVD release, as we have planned now, and it's scheduled for release in the fall of 2012.
Okay, great. Well, we look forward to seeing it, and thank you very much for being on with us today, and look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thanks. My honor. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Scott, thanks again, and I hope you have a great week. I want to thank everybody for joining us live, getting us on the archive. We're going to have a best of next week, but then on the 15th, our guest is going to be Jim Holmes. He's the Associate Professor of Strategy at the Naval War College to discuss offshore balancing. Everybody have a great week and have yourself a great Navy Day.
Molly wrote on me to reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Malone.